Hi, this is Alan Chartok, and I'm delighted to be in conversation today with Rick Winston, author of Red Scare in the Green Mountains, Vermont in the McCarthy Era, 1946 to 1960, from Rustock Publishing. Rick Winston grew up in Yonkers, New York, and attended both Columbia University at University of California, Berkeley. He arrived in Adamant, Vermont in 1970 and still lives there. He started Montpelier's Lightning Ridge Film Society in 1972, which morphed into the Savoy Theater in 1981. He's currently teaching film history in several places, including Community College of Vermont. His longstanding interest in the Red Scare era led him to become one of the organizers of the 1988 Montpelier Conference, Vermont in the McCarthy Era. Rick will be signing copies of the book at the Hudson Area Library on Thursday, September 27th at 6 p.m., where he will speak on the Hollywood Blacklist. We'll talk with the author, Rick Winston, about his book and life, and maybe a bit more about his brother, who I loved, Winnie Winston. But first, welcome, Rick.
Hi, Alan. It's a pleasure to be on your show after hearing you for so many years on the air.
So, Rick, the name of the book is Red Scare in the Green Mountains. But before we go there, let's talk a little bit about you. Obviously, this is a book which lays out the problems of anti-communism and what can go wrong. And, of course, we're in a place right now where we could see some of this emerge again based on who our president is. But even more importantly, it raises what did go wrong and ruined a lot of lives, including suicides, people who went to prison, people who lost their jobs, and all the rest. And it took a great American hero, in my mind, somebody like Edward R. Murrow, to bring some sanity back into it, but a lot of bad things happened in the meantime. You want to add anything to that?
Well, I was curious to hear who you were going to mention as a hero. Because one thing my book talks about is that there were others, including our very own Senator Ralph Landers, who helped bring down McCarthy in the U.S. Senate.
Yep. And you have a wonderful picture in the book of Flanders sort of leaning over the despicable Roy Cohn and McCarthy,
yeah.
Clearly giving them both a piece of his mind.
And, you made the connection with events of today, and people should remember, if they haven't known already, that Roy Cohn, who was McCarthy's protege, 15, 25 years later, became Donald Trump's mentor when Trump was breaking into the New York world of high society and real estate.
Mm-hmm,
so there is a direct link between then and now.
When Roy Cohn died and the obituaries are around, they mentioned some of his troubles, but I got to tell you, not nearly appropriately enough. Maybe that's the problem with obituaries, but the devil himself would have some good things said about them. Rick, let's talk a little bit about you. As we said, you grew up in Yonkers. I first met your family at Bucks Rock Work Camp, where your mom was the arts and crafts director.
Yes. My father actually lost his teaching job during the McCarthy era, and he and my mother, who at that point still had her job
at Music and Art.
Well, she taught first at Washington Irving down Union Square and then at Music and Art High School.
Right.
But as teachers, they had their summers free, and a friend of theirs introduced them to this wonderful place in New Milford, Connecticut, and they were longtime counselors. My father, when he lost his teaching job, went into private business, so he could no longer be a counselor during the summers. But my mother continued there for a while, and I grew up there every summer, and it was really my introduction to a lot of left politics. It was a lot of children of blacklistees wound up going there, and
indeed,
that's where I learned a lot about it.
Indeed. I only spent one summer there in what were then called the prefabs, long gone now. Little houses. And I had wonderful roommates, but I do remember I had one roommate, Jeff Reiter, and he and I didn't have much to do because I picked vegetables for a while on the vegetable farm, and then I went to the arts and crafts once, but I had no talent for that. And so what he and I did was we built a one-hole golf course. And we would go back and forth and play for orange drinks all day long. However, that's not the point. I know it's long-winded, but the point really is is that I looked up and saw a crowd on the porch, the stone porch of Bucks Rock. And I said, well, I wonder what that is. And I put down the golf club I never played again before or since and walked up there. And there was this tall, lanky guy, and he had a banjo in his hand, and that was Pete.
That must have been the summer of 1955.
Yeah, sounds
I was
right.
8 years old, yeah. And a few counselors chipped in to bring Pete Seeger up, who at that point was in the height of the blacklist where he couldn't get very many jobs.
And there was Pete. Now, I think my time may have come a little bit later. When did, help me with this, Rick. When was JFK first running, going to the conventions in order to run for president? Was that 55?
You know, I think he made a vice presidential
run that's the
1956.
One. Yeah, that's the year. That is the year. And there was Pete.
Yeah.
Anyway,
yeah.
My life changed because I watched him. One of the things I loved about your brother, not to deviate too much about this, but I always thought he looked a little like Pete. He wasn't as tall, but I thought they had sort of similar qualities. And your brother?
Lanky and the bouncing Adam's apple. Yeah.
That's right. And your brother?
Pete was a hero to so many young musicians in those days.
Yeah, and your brother would be with a woman named Judy Krasnow. I looked her up. And Tony Sallotan, who then went on to be quite famous.
Yeah. Tony and Judy are still very much with us.
Yes. And they had a group. And guess what they sounded like? They sounded just like the Weavers.
It was no accident if you read the book that Judy wrote about.
Oh, is that right?
Her family, yeah.
I got to get that book. So in any case, to put it mildly, I once was talking to Pete and I was asking him about his politics and he said, well, you know, we're lefties. And he said it proudly. Your family was lefties.
Yes. My parents were both children of immigrants growing up in the Depression, and you came, a lot of those people just came by their politics very naturally, just by looking around. They both became school teachers and saw a lot of inequality in New York and the way the schools were set up and who got the best education and who got inferior education. And they became very strong union members.
You know, that would be so interesting to think about that, because right now there's this fierce debate going on in New York. I know, once again, we're not talking about your book, Red Scare in the Green Mountains, but we will. There's this fierce debate going on, and it is over whether or not there should be a mandatory quotient of minority students admitted into so-called, you know, quality or special or advanced schools, Stuyvesant Science, and all the rest. I wonder where they would have been on that.
Yeah, I have been following that issue from a distance. And I know that one thing my parents were very involved with was racial equality and how it played out in New York City. And it turns out that one of the issues for the teachers back then was racist textbooks. And it turned out that one of the history teachers who wrote that racist textbook by the late 40s was superintendent of schools. So the teachers' union got a lot of pushback. And my father always had the theory that a lot of this anti-communist scare was really a smokescreen for breaking the back of the teachers' union.
Certainly sounds right to me. Anyway, Rick, you're married?
Yes, indeed.
You have kids?
I have a son who's a ICU nurse and a big supporter of the nurses' union in Burlington's Fletcher Allen Hospital.
And is he carrying on in the tradition of his grandparents and his father?
Yeah.
Okay, so let's go to Red Scare in the Green Mountains, Vermont in the McCarthy era, 1946 to 1960. Well, you know, a lot of it, as I read it, just looked so familiar to me in terms of what was going on in the country at the time. This is an interview about you, but I want to tell you, I remember one night my aunt called my mother, she was my honorary aunt, but to say that she had been named in a book.
Named, yeah.
Named. Remember, named if you were named. Named in a book by an ex-communist or a present communist who had written a book and named her. And there was great panic as to whether this would mean that she would be called before the Congress or what could be expected as a result. Nothing happened, but it just permeated everybody's life.
Yeah, and the other part of what being named entailed was not only were you going to get caught and grilled about yourself, but you were going to be asked about who you knew.
And that was central, right? That was central to your book.
Yeah.
You bring it up again and again, and that was an essential part of this. Sure, you'd go and you'd say, were you ever a communist? Yes. Will you name all the other people you knew who were communists with you? No. Go to jail.
Yep. Yeah, and that was it. And if you said, if they asked you, did you know this and this person, and you said no, they might bring a professional perjurer to testify that, yes, indeed, we saw you at that meeting. There were those people who were around who were paid to name people that way.
Now, what was the role of the Fifth Amendment in all of this?
Well, you know, going back to the Hollywood Ten, they really wanted to take the First Amendment. At that time, the Fifth Amendment was associated in the public's mind with mobsters, and they didn't want to be gangsters. You know, they didn't want to appear as gangsters. They wanted to say, yes, I belong to this organization, and you have no right to look into my politics. So the raucous hearings at the Hollywood Ten in 1947 was as a result of writers and some directors not wanting to name anybody to take the First without putting themselves in more jeopardy. They did not want to take the Fifth, but their lawyers thought they had a really good case if they did take the First. But it turns out the composition of the Supreme Court changed, and in a few years it was ruled that they had to go to jail, that taking the First was not a defense if they called you to talk about your past. And that's when people, especially in Hollywood, started taking the Fifth. At least they couldn't be sent to jail for not naming their colleagues. But it was a terrible decision they had to make, because if they took the Fifth, that was tantamount to automatically getting fired by the studios.
You will remember, of course, that Pete did take the First Amendment.
Yes. The timing was fortuitous in Pete Seeger's case. I think it came late enough so that the worst of the hysteria was over. And he actually, if I'm remembering right, he appealed his case and won.
That's correct. That's correct. I don't think they wanted to put Pete in jail. Although they put popular people in jail, there's no question about it. Some of the movie producers and writers and the others went to jail and they came out. They wrote under different names and they got the stuff. You referenced in a previous conversation we had Mike Maripol, one of the two sons of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg. And when he knew your brother, who I like so much, knew Mike Maripol, right?
Yes. Abel and Ann Maripol were the people who adopted the two children of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg. My father had taught with Abel Maripol at DeWitt Clinton High School in the Bronx. Mm. My parents and the Maripols were very good friends, colleagues from the union. And when came time for them to adopt the Rosenberg children, Robbie was exactly my age and Michael was exactly my brother's age. And my older brother, Michael, found a bond in folk music, too. So that's the way that worked out.
And we should mention Strange Fruit.
Yes, which Abel Maripol wrote while he was still teaching high school, and one of the classic songs.
That's right. It had been performed all over the world many times. Okay, so let's go to the book for a moment. Red Scare in the Green Mountains, Vermont in the McCarthy Era, 46 to 60. What made you write it?
Well, no surprise that as a young adult, I was very interested in this era just from everything that my parents had been through. I moved a year out of college to Vermont. It was a very new place to me. It had a very different kind of politics than I was used to. And I got very curious about what had happened here. It was a very almost totally Republican state, but there were quite a few liberal Republicans like George Aiken, who was in the Senate at that time.
Right.
I got curious about how the Red Scare played out here, but I didn't really do anything about it until I met two other people in the late 80s, both of whom had institutional connections. One, Michael Sherman with the Vermont Historical Society. He was the new president of the society, and a longtime history teacher, Richard Hathaway. I forget whose idea it was, but the three of us got together and put on this conference and found people who were still around who could talk to it, like our keynote speaker was William Hinton, a China scholar, and there's a whole chapter about William Hinton in my book and the whole history of the Hinton family, their connection with Communist China and the Putney School. It's a fascinating history. Anyway, we put on this conference that was very successful, but I always thought we had barely scratched the surface of what was there. And I said, oh, well, someday perhaps when I'm not doing, my wife and I ran the Savoy Movie Theater in Montpelier, and I said, sometime when Andrea and I sell the theater, I'll get to work on that McCarthy project again. So that's what happened. And one article led to another and to another. And before you knew it, I had enough to think about putting a book together about nine separate episodes that happened between the years 46 and 60. And I picked those years. You know, McCarthy era and Red Scare have become kind of synonymous. But I like Red Scare better. For one, it's more evocative of the hysteria of the time. And it's important to remember that this thing did not start and end with the career of Joseph McCarthy, which was actually only a very short period, 1950 to 1954. So that's how the book came to be.
So, as you mentioned, you know, you have separate chapters about separate people, and you have a cast of characters, fascinating stories. So perhaps we could go through some of them. You don't have to tell the whole book.
No, I can do that.
So Charles Plumley, vigorous anti-communist Republican, sort of Joe McCarthy, junior grade for Vermont.
Yeah, if Vermont had its own version of McCarthy, it would have been this man, Charles Plumley, who's fiercely anti-labor. He assumed that any organized labor was controlled by the communists and socialists.
Let's remember that Vermont then was not Bernie Sanders' Vermont.
This was certainly true. It was kind of a monolithic Republican state, even though there was a liberal wing of the Republican Party and the conservative wing, and that would have been where Plumley was at home. But if you were going to try to oust Plumley from his congressional seat, you had to do it through the Republican primary, not through the general election, right? Because nobody hardly voted for Democrats in those days.
And what role does Plumley play in the book?
Well, that is my first chapter. It's an episode that takes place in 1946, and it just shows that these strands of fierce anti-communism and reaction were present right from the end of World War II, when the alliance between the U.S. and USSR collapsed, and we think of it as the beginning of the Cold War.
We all knew it was coming, and it came.
So my first chapter deals with the primary of the election of 1946, where a somewhat liberal college professor chose to run against Plumley and was red-baited and lost the election largely due to that.
How was the red-baiting presented?
Well, supposedly, and this was, I say supposedly because this was one of those frustrations. All the principals are gone. I couldn't really figure out what exactly happened. But supposedly, a local chapter of the Communist Party in Barre, Vermont, near where I live, a very strong union town, supposedly the communists had endorsed Plumley's opponent, who's named Andrew Newquist. And one newspaper picked up on that, and it spread to other newspapers. And all of a sudden, Newquist, who had been running this very strong campaign on some issues that he and Plumley disagreed with, rural electrification and the St. Lawrence Seaway and the role of unions, all of a sudden the headlines were, Newquist denies any communist ties.
Yeah.
And that kind of dominated the press until the election.
Now, the press was in on it, right?
Well, some of the press was in on it. There were several very conservative papers in Vermont, and they picked up that ball and ran with it. That's a thread that's in some other chapters, the role of some of the very powerful conservative papers in Vermont, and then the balancing role of some liberal, smaller town papers.
We're talking to Rick Winston, author of Red Scare in the Green Mountains, Vermont in the McCarthy Era, 46 to 60, Rustock Publishing, and he'll be signing copies of the book at the Hudson Area Library on Thursday, September 27th at 6 p.m., where he'll speak on the Hollywood Blacklist. You can find out more at www.redscareinthegreenmountains.com. So, Rick Winston, then What happens to Newquist?
Yes, well, he lost the election. He still had his job at University of Vermont teaching political science. And he's basically said, no, I'm done with that. Never again. You know, I did my thing. Now somebody else can do it. In the meantime, Plumlee stepped down. He had become, in his later years, kind of a figure of fun. People just didn't take him seriously. You know, one of the reasons that things did not happen in Vermont that happened elsewhere is that there were no strong political figures like Lewis Wyman in our neighboring New Hampshire or Philip Bowker in Massachusetts to really take that anti-communist crusade to a new level. When Plumlee tried to introduce a bill to have textbooks censored in the Vermont legislature, the reaction was, Uncle Charlie's at it again. You know, let's just wait till this whole thing blows over.
There goes Charlie again. So Newquist got his apology by the end, didn't he?
Well, he had a very active civic and social life, taught at UVM. He's got an award named after him. He's mentioned in the Vermont Encyclopedia. You know, I found out about this whole episode quite by accident because his son, Andrew Newquist Jr., is a neighbor of mine around here. He's now in his 80s himself. But he said, yeah, you ought to write about my father and how he was renovated by Charlie Plumlee. So there was my first chapter.
Amazing. Okay, so who was Luther McNair?
Luther McNair was an assistant dean of students at one of the big state teachers' college in Linden, Vermont. And he made the mistake of speaking very publicly in favor of Henry Wallace's presidential bid in 1948 on the Progressive Party ticket.
So for all you youngsters, Henry Wallace was the lefty who had been, what, Secretary of Agriculture in the...
Yeah, he was a very popular Secretary of Agriculture.
In the Roosevelt administration, yeah.
He was Roosevelt's vice president in Roosevelt's third term. And one of those great what-ifs in history is, you know, if he had not been replaced by Truman, who was quite the cold warrior himself.
Sure.
And with every aggressive move that Truman made against the Soviet Union, Wallace moved further to the left and finally decided to run on a third-party ticket in 1948, the Progressive Party.
And, of course, lefties of all stripes campaigned very heavily for this guy who had once been vice president of the United States in the Roosevelt administration, including Pete.
There was a whole little army of folk singers who followed Wallace around. And that was the beginning, as I found out, of the was known as the People's Songs movement.
That's right.
So there was one especially conservative paper in Burlington, Vermont, the largest city. And it was run by William Loeb, who came to prominence when he moved to New Hampshire to take over the Manchester Union leader and became kind of a political kingmaker. But in the 40s, he was still in Vermont. And when they heard about the speech that Professor McNair gave, they demanded front page editorials that he be fired. And the logic being, how can somebody who supports the Soviet Union be teaching our impressionable young people? He clearly doesn't have any sense of moral right or wrong. So this was an intense public campaign against McNair, who finally did resign. And I got curious about what happened to him. Turned out he moved to Boston and was a much beloved head of the Massachusetts ACLU for many, many years. And now there's an annual award named after him, too.
Loeb, of course, you have just mentioned. You spent a lot of time on him in the book, but basically he was bringing up the right.
Oh, read some of his editorials. It's just amazing the vitriol that he poured on anybody who was to the left of him. Front page, you know, signed editorials. And Loeb's paper was just about the only paper in Vermont that did not support Senator Flanders when Flanders took on McCarthy.
So let's talk a little bit about Flanders. Go ahead.
Flanders was, turns out, a very unlikely person to become a crusading hero of the left. We think of it as the left, but he was a very successful Republican businessman, had his own tool and die factory, and there was something in McCarthy's personality and methods that really rubbed him the wrong way. that he felt that McCarthy was giving anti-communism a bad name by making these baseless charges, and that he was doing the Republican Party a great disservice. Flanders felt that McCarthy was doing his best to destroy the Republican Party. As it turned out, Eisenhower, who was president at the time, had much the same point of view and tacitly agreed with Flanders that, you know, if Flanders went ahead and attacked McCarthy, Ike would not stand in his way.
And we will remember, of course, those of us who either lived it or were around in that time, we will remember that Ike himself started to get implicated by stupid McCarthy. You know, Eisenhower wasn't exactly filled with courage over all of this stuff, but when it was his ox that was being gored, you can bet he spoke up.
Yes, and to go back to some of the newspapers and memoirs of the time, it was McCarthy taking on one of the great American institutions, the Army, that really brought him down, that there were people who were cowed by McCarthy every step of the way. But he overshot his mark when he took on the Army.
And said there were a lot of communists in the Army. Yeah. Which is interesting.
And then there were all the people who were just sitting on the sidelines rubbing their hands when he basically brought himself down by his own overweening self-confidence.
Well, it's so interesting that you say that because, of course, Rick Winston, it has to go through everybody's mind that we're seeing the same kind of egotistical, narcissistic behavior with this president, who is also bringing himself down step by step by talking about the deep state, talking about the FBI being filled with basically traitors, and the Justice Department and his own attorney general and everybody else. So there's got to be some comparability here, right?
I would hope so. We haven't really seen the institutional pushback that really make it a fight. We'll see what happens. What is ironic that here's a man, our president, who will be the first to cry McCarthyism, witch hunt, but simultaneously he uses the McCarthy textbook of dealing with your enemies. Lie early, lie often, demean everybody who disagrees with you. You know, it's classic Joe McCarthy.
It's also classic Hitler. I mean, if you look at what Hitler did in the beginning, same stuff.
Well, you know, if you go to the dictionary and look up McCarthy, it's McCarthyism. It's a discredited phenomenon. You know, nobody is going to proudly say, I'm a McCarthyite, except those on the way, way right. So you can say, this reeks of McCarthyism without having people look too closely at what you're actually doing.
Well, you were referencing before, Rick Winston, you were referencing the Henry Wallace campaign, and that brings us to Rockwell Kent. What was that all about?
Rockwell Kent was a very politically committed, quite a popular artist from the 20s on. Incredibly talented printmaker, graphic artist, painter, but his political sympathies were with the Soviet Union from the very get-go. And whether he was a member of the Communist Party, I don't know. You didn't have to be a member of the Communist Party to support the Soviet Union. It was clear from a lot of people who went that route. But the college group at University of Vermont in support of Wallace thought they had a great coup, and they invited Rockwell Kent to speak on campus in favor of Wallace. Kent at the time had a farm in upstate New York near Plattsburgh, so it wasn't very much of a drive for him. But he gave quite an incendiary speech, and the headline in the Burlington Free Press the next day was Rockwell Kent, something like, welcomes aid from commies. And Rockwell Kent basically in the speech said, well, what's wrong with the communists helping us? Better than all those capitalist crooks that are supporting Truman. So that didn't go over too well with some of the more conservative commentators.
Didn't go well. Let me ask you a question as an old lefty, and this is a bit of my own baiting of you. But, you know, considering everything we have learned about Stalin later in life, and for all those people who supported the Soviet Union, who, after all, won the war for America, there's no two ways about it. Do you have second thoughts about all those people who had good things to say about Russia and about the Soviet Union in those days, but supported really a heinous dictator?
Yes, sometimes I joke with my friends, my contemporaries, whose parents were all in the same social circle. I said we should have a group called Adult Children of Deluded Stalinists, because my parents were not one of them, but I knew some of my parents' friends who defended Stalin till their dying breaths. And, you know, it was unfortunate. I started reading about everything that went on in the Soviet Union in the 30s and the 40s. And granted, not a lot of that was public for a long time. But
sure,
there certainly were people who left the Communist Party because of their suspicions of what was happening in the Soviet Union. And one person, I'll be talking about this person in my talk on the Hollywood Blacklist, somebody like Bud Schulberg.
Sure.
Who, as a writer, went to the Soviet Union and sang its praises and met all these wonderful young Soviet writers. And he discovered during the 40s that one by one, they were all disappearing, and especially the ones that were Jewish. So Schulberg had a great about-face about his support of Stalin, and he became an informer. And he basically said, I don't owe anything to these people. You know, they're killing my friends, whether they know it or not. So there were people who definitely left the Communist Party because of this, and some waited until 1956 with the Khrushchev's so-called secret speech. But I think there was a feeling on the part of diehard leftists that, what, you're going to let J. Edgar Hoover know that he was right about something? God forbid.
Yeah.
Which is why it's, I think the lesson that I've gotten from it is that one of the enemies is really true believerism of any kind,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Political fundamentalism. It gets you into these traps. You've got to be a real critical thinker about political movements.
We're talking with Rick Winston, author of Red Scare in the Green Mountains, Vermont in the McCarthy Era, 46 to 60. He'll be signing copies of his book at the Hudson Area Library on Thursday, September 27th at 6 p.m. We'll speak on the Hollywood Blacklist. You can find out more at www.redscareinthegreenmountains.com. Okay, so Rick, let's go back to work here on the book. I wanted to mention one other thing on the theme you were just on. When I asked Pete in one of my interviews with him whether he had any regrets, Pete Seeger, of course, he said, yeah, he had one, which was you can't ever support one strong man running a country. And that is, of course, a direct reference to Stalin, as I like to call him, and as I think they called him. But in any case, Rick, let's go back to work. We talked about Rockwell Kent, fascinating story. Now let's talk about James Hayford, the farmer, poet, and teacher.
Yes, James Hayford is an interesting, very flinty Vermonter, poet, musician. He was one of the first faculty members at Goddard College and a progressive college right here in Plainfield.
Let me just say that when my mother got mad at me, she would always say, I'm going to send you to Goddard College for a course in human relations.
Now, there is a great threat. I've got to tell some people about that. So Hayford was a farmer and a poet, but he was also a political activist, and he was one of the people who signed on early and enthusiastically to Henry Wallace, to the point that he was a delegate to the big convention in Philadelphia that summer, 1948. And he was an independent thinker, and he did not like what he was hearing on the floor that was mainly condemnations of United States foreign policy, but no such condemnations of Soviet foreign policy.
Mm.
And he introduced a motion on the floor to put in an amendment to that effect that we, you know, should not be supporting any kind of aggression anywhere. And he got hooted down, and he came back to Vermont and basically said, I have had it with politics. And his conservative friends thought he was a communist, and his left-wing friends thought he was becoming a reactionary. And he said, I guess this political world is not for me. So he just kept being a farmer and a poet, and but still a supporter of good causes till the end. And I quote a letter that he wrote in 1989 to the Burlington Free Press on the occasion of them, the university, officially apologizing for their treatment of a professor that had been fired. That's a whole other chapter in the book. Hayford said to the Free Press, while you're at it, how about apologizing to all the people who worked for Wallace who you slandered? So he was still a very passionate spokesperson.
Well, let's go to a man named Stephenson, whose first name I find unpronounceable, so you'll pronounce it for us.
I'll pronounce it Vihalmor.
See what I mean?
It's an Icelandic name. He was of Icelandic. But I've heard that he did like to be called William. It's basically the Icelandic version of William.
Okay, so now what did he do? You know, his land sale, 1950. What was that all about?
Yeah, well, this was one of the most fascinating chapters for me to work on. We didn't cover this at the conference, and that was when I said that I always thought we'd only scratch the surface. This was one story that we didn't do anything about. Stephenson had been an Arctic explorer, a very well-known one during the teens and to the early 20s. And he lived in New York City, got a summer place with his wife in Vermont. He became very, very good friends with Owen Lattimore, who is an expert on the Far East. Lattimore had been Roosevelt's personal emissary to Chiang Kai-shek. That's how high up Lattimore was. Lattimore was very concerned about the approaching takeover of China by the communists, strictly because of his friends in Mongolia who were fighting for some kind of autonomy. Some land came up for sale abutting Stephenson's, so Lattimore bought it with the hopes of starting a school for Asiatic studies and getting some Mongolians in exile to be there. However, these plans went awry because the rise of Joseph McCarthy, and he first made national headlines in February of 1950, charging that there were so many, he kept changing the number, but there were communists in the State Department. Anyway, McCarthy charged that Lattimore was the ringleader of this spying in the State Department, which came as a big surprise to Lattimore because he didn't even work in the State Department.
Yeah.
But Lattimore knew that he was going to be mired in legal difficulties for a while. His lawyer, incidentally, was future Supreme Court Justice Abe Fortas.
Hmm.
And Lattimore said to his friend Stephenson, I'm going to have to sell this land. And Stephenson said, don't worry about a thing. I'll sell it for you. Stephenson put an ad in the Saturday Review of Literature, and only one person answered the ad, and that person bought the land, and it later became known that this person actually had run for governor of Alabama on the communist ticket in 1942. So when the story came out, the headlines were, McCarthy charges land sale in Vermont aids communists. It became a big controversy for about 2 weeks in the summer of 1950. And one of the things I write about in this chapter is that the controversy was totally diffused through the work of three very brave newspaper editors working together to chip in and to hire their own investigative journalist from New York to come up. And they ran a six-issue series as a front-page article on each day for 6 days, all the parameters of this so-called scheme to aid the communists, and completely diffused the issue. That was quite a fascinating story.
And then another chapter, fascinating story, is of the chief red bedder in Vermont, a woman named Lucille Miller. What about her?
Well, she was not a red baiter like Charlie Plumlee, who had actually had a position in the U.S. Congress. She was just a local person, a Vermont native, who lived in the Bethel, Vermont area for a long time. And she had seen some of these people from the city coming up and buying summer homes, not only in Lattimore, but others as well. And she got very suspicious, and she tried to get anybody who would listen to her that commies were taking over Vermont. And one of the people who she fed news items to was the very influential right-wing columnist Westbrook Pegler.
Oh, yeah.
I think of as the Rush Limbaugh of his day. And he really fanned the flames thanks to her. I reprint one column that he wrote that's headlined, "Vermont Yankees Are Suckers for Commies."
Do you think there was an anti-Semitic tinge there?
There certainly was under the surface.
Because where I live, you know, in Great Barrington, Massachusetts, when we first got there, I don't hear it anymore. We first got there when people would say to us who were, you know, arguing, is that you New Yorkers. And I never had any doubt what that meant.
Yeah. Yes. You know, people have different theories about this. The only actual Jewish person who figures prominently in my book is the professor Alex Novikov, the one who got fired from University of Vermont. He had taken the Fifth before a Senate committee, and that led to his firing. But he had a chief defender on the UVM faculty named Arnold Schein. And Arnold's two children are still around. I had a long interview with his daughter, Susan, who said, definitely there was anti-Semitism in Vermont, in Burlington especially. It played into how people felt about both her father and Novikov. And you go back to some of these news articles, and they will always put the adjective Russian-born. Russian-born Novikov. He came over when he was six with his parents, but, you know, the implication was clear.
A long time between then and Bernie Sanders, yes?
Bernie figures at the very, very tail end of the book, and I'm sure Bernie would have a thing or two to say about anti-Semitism in Vermont.
Yeah. Well, the first time I heard him speak, and I was with him, and, you know, he spoke in that Brooklyn accent, it was astounding to me that this guy was now the United States Senator for Vermont.
We still find it hard to believe, after all these years, that somebody who speaks like that and with that manner could inspire the trust of so many old-time Vermonters, because he couldn't get elected without their support, for sure.
Well, tell us about John Drysdale, Rick Winston, publisher and editor of the White River Valley Herald.
Now, John Drysdale was described to me by his son as a pretty straight-ahead liberal Republican. He had two newspapers that published weekly, and I had one of those epiphanies that historians get every once in a while. I walked into the newspaper office, and his son was still the editor-publisher of that paper.
Wow.
And I introduced myself. I told him what I was after. And he said, wait a minute. And he went back into his office, and he came back out with a big folder that was labeled Bethel Red Scare 1950. And he said, my father put all the clippings in this one folder, and I guess it was just waiting for you to come in and want to see what was in it. So this land sale was right smack where Drysdale put out his paper.
You mean the communist land scale, in quotes? Yeah.
Yes. And when Drysdale realized how big the story was getting, and he only had a weekly, that's when he prevailed on his two friends, one in Rutland, Robert Mitchell, and the other in Brattleboro, John Hooper, who had dailies, to hire this investigative reporter. So Drysdale was quite a hero in this book. He saw the hysteria was about to get under control, and just ran one wonderful editorial after another, warning people we have to pay attention to what the facts really are. We can't let this hysteria get the better of us, and here's what really happened.
Now, we haven't got to the whole book, and we're out of time, basically, so yeah. I wanted to ask you real quickly about Ralph Flanders. Again, we've already talked about him, but he was a heroic figure.
Yes, he certainly didn't have to do what he did. And, you know, there were a lot of people in the Senate who were just waiting for somebody else to take this guy on.
To take McCarthy.
Flanders may have felt that he had nothing to lose, that he was getting to be of an age where he probably wasn't going to run again. But I found it a very inspiring story to explore, especially as we sit around today reading the news every day and waiting for somebody to do something like that instead
Indeed.
Of saying, I think this president is outrageous and therefore I'm not going to run again.
Yeah, very hard when you have an 82% approval rating among Republicans in the United States, and that they will certainly run somebody in a primary, Trump will,
in case
you speak your mind. The guys who have some nerve are the people who are quitting and leaving the Republicans, so they have nothing to lose. But you're quite right. You're quite right. It takes a profile and courage, and we sure haven't seen any of that, or very little of it. We're out of time. We've been talking with Rick Winston, author of Red Scare in the Green Mountains, Vermont in the McCarthy Era, 1946 to 1960, from Rustock Publishing. Rick will be signing copies of the book at the Hudson Area Library on Thursday, September 27th at 6 p.m., where he will speak on the Hollywood blacklist. You can find out more at www.redscareinthegreenmountains.com.
And you can also order the book at your favorite local indie bookstore, preferably.
Indeed.
Hope to see some of your listeners in Hudson.
I'm sure you will. Great to talk to Rick Winston, who I want to mention one more time, is the brother of the great and late Winnie Winston, best banjo player I ever heard in my whole life. And Rick, thanks so much for making all this time for us.
Thank you, Alan. It's been a great pleasure talking with you.
Been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on WAMC's In Conversation with Alan series, or to order a physical copy, call 1-800-323-9262 or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or on the Google Play Store.